the Republicans to wake up is... What the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the Left Coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for downloading the very latest podcast from peterbcollins.com. My thanks to subscribers including Todd Sanchioni, Jason Ferguson, John Dickerson, and Cheryl Curry. You make this program possible, and I am grateful for your support. If you haven't taken out a subscription yet, it's easy to do. It just takes a minute or two via PayPal. The links are right below my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Before the end of this podcast, Will Durst will check in with a satirical commentary on a subject of his choice. I think it's about the Chinese Prime Minister's visit to California, but we'll find out as that occurs. And we got a little taste of Graham Nash's song for Bradley Manning called Almost Gone before my computer hiccuped there. Trying to do too many things at one time because the Skype connection to journalist Kevin Gostola is on the same computer. And Kevin joins us from, I believe, nearby Fort Meade, Maryland, where he has been covering the Bradley Manning trial in its first week. Kevin, welcome back to our program today.
Hello. And then for your listeners, I'm in D.C.
Oh, okay. You have escaped from Fort Meade because there was a recess called after the third day of proceedings. We'll get to that in a moment. But first, Kevin, I want to thank you for the journalistic service you are providing, because every day I go to FireDogLake.com to find the detailed coverage that the corporate media is not even attempting to provide. And while there was a flurry of mainstream media coverage on day one, they quickly moved on. And you're there slogging it out, live blogging on a daily basis. And you're a young journalist, and I point that out not to, criticize you, but to say that you bring a lot of energy and independence to this coverage. And you're not being told by editors to drop in for a few minutes, see what's going on, and then cover something else.
That is correct. My editor-in-chief, Jane Hampshire, deserves a lot of credit for making a lot of this possible. The people who are regular readers, we receive donations. People help get me to Fort Meade. I live in Chicago. I don't know if your listeners realize that, but there are numerous journalists in and around D.C. who have decided that they're not going to cover these proceedings. It has fallen on a small group of people, many who don't even live nearby Fort Meade at all, who are coming in from New York City or are coming, in my case, from Chicago to make sure that people can get this information.
And Kevin, are you currently in a bird cage or an aviary? I hear the tweet of birds behind you.
Well, I'm sitting outside.
I see.
So if this is disrupting our conversation too much, I may be able to relocate. But
No, we'll work with it. We just wanted to make sure it's not some government surveillance program or a drone posing as a bird in the background there.
Or both.
Yeah. If you would, set the scene for us, because protesters gathered several days before Monday's opening proceedings of the Bradley Manning court-martial. Tell me a little bit about the tone of those who have gathered to support Bradley Manning during this critical period, and the arrangements at Fort Meade for both journalists, independents like you, and spectators.
There were probably anywhere between 500 to 800 supporters that did come do a major rally on Saturday. And these people are some of the most dedicated supporters of Bradley Manning's from around the country. They boarded buses and traveled, and they went to the gates of Meade. They marched. They put up with roadblocks on the gates. They put up with all the pumping out of warnings and alerts by the local police and the military base about how people were going to be coming into this area and there would be traffic disruption. And you know that many of them were getting ugly stares while they were outside of the base showing their support for Bradley Manning. On the first day of the proceedings, they had people there. They were going into the public gallery, the supporters. They were in a trailer outside watching a feed. Some of them, I think, ended up in an auditorium that was for overflow. They actually ended up having an issue where a military police officer who had not been doing security during the pretrial process came in and made his own decision or her own decision that individuals were going to turn their black T-shirts inside out. They had white letters on it that say truth. Mm-hmm. They've been wearing these because they weren't allowed to wear the more explicit Free Bradley Manning shirts. So they've been wearing these, and they were told to turn them inside out under the seemingly genuine suggestion that perhaps by doing this, it would prevent the possibility of them being seated next to somebody who opposes Bradley Manning and getting into an argument. This is fairly far-fetched and absurd. But the fact is that there wasn't any legitimate reason for this decision to be made. Someone in the higher-ups in the military police decided to do this to these people, and this was something that the Bradley Manning supporters had to confront on the first day of the trial. We've also been seeing that the military police on the first day surrounded Bradley Manning so that photographers could not get a clear shot of him for the news wires, for the articles that were being shared widely to be published in the newspapers the next day on Tuesday. So that was an issue. We had a bit of a situation where we weren't sure that a crowdfunded stenographer that has been brought in by the Freedom of the Press Foundation was going to be able to be inside the media center to bring us these transcripts. And they ended up having to take the credential of the Bradley Manning Support Network in order to be on the first day of the trial, because there were only, according to the military, 70 seats in the media center, and there had been 350 requests to be in there to do coverage. And so they said, help us to understand that we have fire codes we have to obey, and we can't accommodate everyone. Rather than open another space for all the journalists that were suddenly interested in being present, they denied people access. And I think to close here, and you'll have questions, it would be just to say how I think it is upsetting that we, the humanity of the world, have to fund a stenographer so that we can have transcripts of Bradley Manning. Our government, the military specifically, should be releasing transcripts of the trial on a daily basis as they happen. I think it's very commendable and extraordinary that media organizations and citizens of the world came together to make a stenographer be able to be there so we can have this record. I'm going to find it tremendously helpful to my reporting throughout the entire summer. But the point needs to be made, the government should be providing this service, not some private group.
And Kevin, I am just taking a stab at this, but I feel very confident in what I'm about to say. The military prosecutors get a daily transcript, don't they? I
wish I could give you a yes or no answer to that. They've been circumspect about giving a direct response to that question. I've heard that they're recording audio, and if they want a transcript, the judge will order it. I've heard that there are transcripts, but they're just not releasing them. So I don't know.
Okay. Well, it's a fundamental of a free and open trial that transcripts be made available to both defense and prosecution counsel. And it has always been a gesture at transparency to make those available to the media. One of the other issues that appears to have gotten some resolution this week is that they have declined to publish a schedule of which witnesses will testify on what day. And corporate media reporters apparently stomped their Gucci's loudly enough that the judge, I guess, didn't address this, but other court officers are now offering a bit of a preview of at least the proceedings for the next few days. Is that right?
This is how it's working. But I have to say that, you know, while I like to have this transparency, and I don't really care in the end the motives for journalists trying to get this transparency, but it should be acknowledged that the reporter who was asking this question about whether there could be witnesses made public was asking this question so he could get out of having to be there covering the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Because they want to, from afar, track the proceedings and decide when, you know, if news is going to break, we'll get somebody there that day to cover this witness and the testimony. And they just, you know, some of them actually, I know this and can say this as fact, are just following my coverage at FireDogLake.com right now and using it because it's better than actually taking the time to be there. They'd rather reference it and make a determination on whether to get down to Fort Meade and cover.
Now, do they actually credit your coverage, or do they just steal it and not acknowledge you?
Well, so I did an interview today on a San Francisco radio station for a very good program called Your Call.
Uh-huh.
And I was on with a McClatchy reporter who was crediting me. I mean, he wasn't being derisive towards me. He said that he welcomed my work. He welcomed the work of a colleague of mine, Alexa O'Brien, who did a lot of work to get a public record of the pretrial process out for this Bradley Manning trial. And I just note that there is a bit of a service I'm providing to media, and it seems to be one that is worth questioning because I think they should be there.
Yeah.
I think that you can't just swoop in every 2 or 3 days to cover this trial.
Oh, that jet in the background is Charlie Savage flying back to New York.
He doesn't want to stay at Fort Meade and cover, and his sole source, Adrian Lamo, already testified, but that's another story.
Mm-hmm.
But just the thing is that people need to realize that those people who aren't there regularly won't have as good of a grasp of how everything is developing, because even if you think there aren't headlines or breaking news on key days, then you still have to document it yourself for your own purposes so that you can have that as background when you do think that there is breaking news.
Now, Kevin, without trying to read the minds of the corporate media reporters who are covering the trial sketchily, as you just described, do you think that there is a jaded mindset that, look, the details of this trial really don't matter? It's the verdict that comes at the end. And I think many of these reporters already have figured out, or they think they've figured out, what the outcome of this trial will be.
I had multiple people, when I did interviews the first day, just want to know how long he was going to be sentenced. And I had to stop one person and say, we haven't even had the trial yet. He hasn't been convicted of these other charges. So let's not jump to, you know, how long are you going to be in this jail cell and not have your life and have that taken away from you. Let's talk about what is going to unfold over the course of the next couple of months here. I think it's very important to get into the larger issues around some of the federal charges that the military intends to pursue. And I have questioned this because I think they do want to either just jump to, you know, telling people this is what he confessed to, This is what he hasn't confessed to, and he's going to be sentenced this much, possibly. And that's that. Or they want to have these very, I think they're awful conversations that don't give anybody any information about what's going on, about whether is Manning a hero or is Manning a traitor. But personally, I don't really care whether he's a hero or a traitor, because when I'm in the courtroom at Fort Meade, there are much more significant points or issues that I would like to explore in my coverage than whether your opinion of Bradley Manning is that he's a hero or a traitor.
Well, and as we look at this, tell me what your thoughts are, having spent 3 days in this court-martial proceeding. Do you think it's fair? And do you feel that the judge, who is the sole trier here, there is no jury, and that was Bradley Manning's choice, he was asked to reaffirm it on the first day of the trial, but do you get a sense that she is a scrupulously fair judge? Or do you feel that as a military officer in uniform, cognizant of the chain of command, that she's just kind of going through the motions?
Well, I can make remarks that go to both of that, so I don't know if I would necessarily make it an either-or.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of indication, as one would expect, that she is a career military judge. She's going to look out for her future, and she's not going to issue a decision that tests the military culture. And she's very well aware that it's actually more sacrosanct in the military to safeguard national security secrets, as they would claim them to be, or they call it national defense information. It's more sacrosanct than killing innocent civilians. So you have, in this case, Bradley Manning facing more time in prison than some people who were responsible for massacres of Iraqis. So we'll just put that out there mm-hmm. as part of the larger context. But then I'm going to be putting together a post, and I hope this is something you can look forward to next week, is going back to the transcripts, these very valuable transcripts that have been produced. I'm going to pull out the different times that the prosecutors had objections to lines of questioning the defense were opening in the courtroom, and show how Coombs was able to beat this back and how the judge actually just would not go along with the prosecutor's objections and allowed Coombs to continue. And in being able to continue, we were able to get some very important details out, some very important testimony on the record that I think is going to help Manning in the end. Just for example, briefly, I would add that they got something that went directly to this idea that Manning had actual knowledge, that by providing information to WikiLeaks, he would have been aiding the enemy. So this Captain Casey Fulton, who had been ahead of the intelligence section where he worked, mm-hmm. was asked by David Coombs, can you tell me if you had a list inside the facility where you worked of websites where the enemy would go to get information? She didn't really know what he was asking. He asked it again, and she said, well, there's social networking sites like Facebook that we do operational security briefings, and we tell soldiers not to put information up here. There's Google Maps. And she wasn't really sure that she was actually answering the question, and I think Coombs was satisfied, because that, to me, tells me that there wasn't any discussion inside this unit or even in information training about WikiLeaks being this organization that you would know without a doubt as a soldier, don't put information up on this website, don't disclose it here. The enemy will go there and they will use it to attack the United States. And the prosecutors, some of their more wild claims rest on this idea that Manning would have known WikiLeaks was a place where the enemy went to get information on the United States, and that Coombs was able to completely undermine.
Mm-hmm. And I just want to add, we've been discussing the judge. Her name is Colonel Denise Lind, and we didn't actually
right.
name her as we launched into that description. And Kevin, with that in mind, the back and forth between the chief prosecutor, Captain Joe Morrow, and David Coombs, the defense attorney, is more or less one of the issues in play is the extent to which Bradley Manning was selective in not releasing documents that could give aid or comfort to the enemy, that could specifically talk about targeting or targeting strategies, those sorts of things. And I heard Joe Morrow offer things that sounded like lies to me, because in one of his opening statements that was lifted and quoted by Charlie Savage in the New York Times, he made the allegation that, you know, Manning should have known, and also that it would aid the enemy, and also that he was careless in releasing hundreds of thousands of documents. But Coombs actually showed in eliciting testimony from several people that there was information that was readily available to Private Manning that he did not give to WikiLeaks. So it seems to me that in the first few days, and I'm not there, I'm relying on your reports and others, that Coombs was able to offset many of the damaging allegations fronted by the prosecution.
I've said this before, just generally, before I respond to this with specifics from the past few days, that he had access to the full secret network inside of this facility, which had hundreds upon hundreds of millions of documents. Had he wanted to, had he really had some sort of goal to just make everything go public far and wide and dump it out on the internet, he could have done that. He really could have. I believe that he could have turned the spigot on and just let it all flow. But that's not something that he did with WikiLeaks. He was very selective in what he disclosed, as shown through his statement that he had a purpose for releasing each of these sets of documents or the videos. And I would bring in something that came up these past few days. The fact that we found out a little more about what Bradley Manning was doing, and he apparently was involved in the collection of intelligence, or the putting together of work products that could be used to decide if a high-value target had become some individual that met actionable criteria to where the government could go and kill or capture this person. So we're talking about alleged terrorists or people they believe were enemies. And he had the whole list of 25 or 30 people who were Shiites in Iraq, who were, I assume, leaders, leading terrorists to our government. And he could have provided this list to WikiLeaks, and he could have shared this if he had wanted to. But we never saw any of this. I don't think you ever saw any of this, or anyone ever saw any of this. So it's clear that he knew that there was some information he just wasn't going to disclose. Even though you or I might have liked to have seen this information, I certainly would have written about it if it became public, he was selective in what he provided.
And has any witness so far punctured that argument? The argument that he was selective, and that he did take care not to release information, for example, that could actually put fellow service members at risk.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were asking. No, the prosecutor has put up no witness to rebut the testimony that Coombs is managing to get out in the courtroom that Manning, in fact, was selective.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, what they would just tell you in response is that, well, Manning had no right to make this decision as a soldier. There are people who are classification authorities that are authorized to make that decision. There are people, maybe commanding officers, that could be in a position to decide whether to disclose. There are dates on the documents for declassification 25 or 30 years from now, so that doesn't actually make me feel better. But the fact of the matter is they would just say that Manning signed non-disclosure agreements and he knew that this information was to be safeguarded, and so it really doesn't matter if he was selective. However, it does go to the wantonly. They agree that they, in their charge, they say he wantonly caused to be published intelligence about the United States. But it's not very wantonly if you actually were selective in your choice.
So as we look at this, the real effort of the David Coombs defense team is to try to maintain a clear message to the court that while he did in fact release, you know, massive amounts of information, that he was careful about it, and that it did not rise above the level of secret. This is one of the things that the president himself erroneously stated in his comment to a guy named Logan at the fundraiser in San Francisco in April of 2011, when Obama engaged in a dialogue about the Bradley Manning case and flatly said that Manning broke the law, but also he misstated the level of secured information that Manning is alleged to have released. So it seems to me that through the original process in February of admitting to the court, essentially pleading guilty to some of the lesser counts, that the strategy here is to try to keep the charges within a kind of a containment mode so that the judge would ultimately say, well, yes, he's admitted he broke the law, but it's not as bad as what the government has alleged. And what we're really jockeying around here is what the ultimate sentence might be for Bradley Manning.
It really goes after the government for overreaching. And I think the momentum that the prosecutors have with this case has become such that they weren't able to pull back. And I hope I suspect that could have a role in their inability to prove up some of these charges. The fact that they did not accept the guilty plea and go with the maximum sentence of 20 years, being dishonorably discharged, being fined by the military, being, I think, labeled for life as somebody who had betrayed his military oath. We can debate whether that's true or not, but I think there's a wide array of different circles in America that would have regarded Bradley Manning as someone who had not been a good soldier. And so they could have had that satisfaction that they had nailed him, but it wasn't good enough. They wanted to go forward. They wanted to get him on Espionage Act charges. They want to get him for aiding the enemy. They want to get him for stealing the information. And so, yes, Coombs is doing a basically a mitigation sort of defense, a containment, showing the character of Bradley Manning, pay attention to a lot of the testimony he's trying to get from witnesses. It goes to the character of Bradley Manning, asking them, did he have anti-American views? They say no. Did he sympathize with terrorists ever? They say no. Did he do any of this other activity that you might associate with people who had become turncoats or traitors? So they say no. So absent that evidence and being able to show the character of Bradley Manning, it makes it very difficult for them to make these allegations that he was aiding terrorists.
Now, as you look back, it's been a few days, but at the opening statement from Captain Morrow, this is where the prosecution typically lays out a blueprint of or a little roadmap of where it's going to go. Were there any surprises? For example, we know about the plan to bring in lightly disguised individuals whose names will be changed and who will be testifying about SEAL Team 6 having found WikiLeaks-related documents in Abbottabad, Pakistan. Were there any other tidbits or teasers that surfaced in the prosecution's opening statement?
Well, I won't go into too much detail, though I possibly could, but I think that one of the things that came out that I wrote extensively, or I wrote up just so people could see, was how this report that Manning disclosed, this Army intelligence report from 2008 on WikiLeaks, and what they believed was the role of WikiLeaks in enemies being able to go there and see this information, I put up how they were going to argue that Manning would have had knowledge that WikiLeaks was a place the enemy would go to. I haven't seen David Coombs test this argument in court yet. I'm not sure how he'll confront it. But personally, my response to it was just that it was interesting that they were suggesting that even though Manning, to them, is someone who should not have read that report, they're willing to say, all right, even though you weren't authorized, you read it, you had knowledge, you knew in your research that WikiLeaks was a dangerous entity because we made that conclusion, and you may have disputed it, but look, you read an official report on what we think about WikiLeaks, and by that, you would have known not to provide this information to that organization. And so the preview that we're getting here is that there is going to be at least some testimony where we are contesting the nature of WikiLeaks. I just prepare people for that, that there will be open court, the prosecutors trying to show WikiLeaks is an organization that is intent on exfiltrating national security secrets from the United States government, from insiders. And then the David Coombs is going to try to rebut that by showing that WikiLeaks is in fact a media organization, much like the New York Times, that should, you know, maybe it doesn't operate like it, but it enjoys legally the same rights of the New York Times. And I think that was remarkable. In the blueprint that they were presenting, I was seeing that going forward. I was also seeing in the blueprint that they're going to make these claims about Manning trying to help or work for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. And that is very alarming, I think, if you're Julian Assange. It's very alarming if you're the lawyers who represent WikiLeaks. It's been my thought all along that in the larger picture, we need to see that the military prosecutors are playing a role that the U.S. government wants them to play. And I think that in their perfect world, they would like the judge to make some kind of determination about WikiLeaks so that it would enable a government prosecution of Julian Assange, of staffers, of volunteers who have been involved in this, so that you could have them brought before a court and charged with conspiracy to commit espionage or any other charges that they might cook up.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And were there any other statements that rang hollow or as exaggerations or, in fact, things that you thought to be untrue offered by Captain Morrow in his opening statement?
I mean, off the top of my head, I'm thinking about the dumping. I'm thinking about how, and this is actually in Alex Gibney's We Steal Secrets movie, which has quite a bit of inaccuracies and information that to an extent rises to the level of propaganda, but there is no confirmation yet presented by the government that in fact Julian Assange was using this chat account that they say links him to Bradley Manning. Bradley Manning thought, he says this in his statement, he thought Julian Assange might have been chatting with him. He was not able to confirm it. He doesn't know. He thought that there might be someone using a pseudonym who could have been Julian Assange who was using this account, but he didn't confirm that either. This was all in the mind of Bradley Manning, and he has admitted that he developed his own perception about who he was talking to on the other end. So we just don't know yet, and so we should not say definitively, as the prosecutors are saying in open court, that there is, in fact, a link established, that, in fact, Assange and Manning were having conversations and were talking about how to make these disclosures to WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm. Kevin Gostola, on day two, Adrian Lamo took the stand, and he is someone who was a friend of Bradley Manning's and essentially turned him in after becoming uncomfortable with some of the email and chat exchanges that the two had. Describe Adrian Lamo and your sense of his credibility.
Lamo is, he's a convicted felon. He was convicted of hacking into systems. He also hacked into the New York Times. And that's important to know because then that made him a candidate to be a government informant, exactly the kind of person who our government would want to use to help catch people who are in hacker circles, who the government wants to stop from being able to operate. And Adrian Lamo was put into contact. He got into contact with Bradley Manning because Manning was apparently seeking him out after he watched a documentary that had leaked. And he knew that Lamo had encouraged donations to WikiLeaks, and he wanted to confide in him. He wanted to share his personal, you know, his most personal thoughts, what was going through his mind about the leaks he was making to WikiLeaks, what he was providing. And Lamo, I think on the first day, made the decision that what he was hearing was something he was going to act upon, and he was going to turn him in to the federal authorities. What's always stuck out to me about Adrian is that he was doing the government's dirty work for the next 3 or 4 days. He was chatting with Bradley Manning, getting him to make incriminating statements that could be used against Bradley Manning during this trial. And this was big for the government, I believe. And actually, I presume that if Manning had never contacted Lamo, he might have been able to go a lot longer without being caught. They didn't know who was releasing this information when the collateral murder video became public in April. I don't know if they would have known when the Warlocks became public in the summer. And then, so Lamo now is someone who has no remorse for what he's done. He makes these claims about how he would be happy if Bradley Manning got 6 months, and that's what he deserves in prison. But it's clear that he's going to face much more time in jail. So he's never confronted the fact that Bradley Manning is actually going to be put in prison for a very long amount of time. He claims to really sympathize and understand what Bradley Manning was thinking. And he tries to present himself as a sort of someone who empathizes with Manning, but then at the same time, he'll willingly cast aspersions on Manning by making these statements, as you can read in transcripts, that suggest that there was maybe something else going on with Manning, that it wasn't just genuine whistleblowing, that in fact he was maybe working for WikiLeaks and was trying to endanger people. I'm leaving the door open for the prosecutors to make these arguments when he knows full well that he was coming to this information just like he would have come to this information when he was 22 years old.
And was there anything that you observed in the courtroom, any exchange of glances, or did Manning look at Lamo as he was testifying? Anything that gave you any detail about their former relationship, their former connection?
Nothing particular. I have to be honest that Manning's fairly calm, and particularly I think even with Lamo, he didn't become too animated. I will say that when I covered his testimony back in December 2011 for the Article 32 hearing, and Lamo had far more to say, and his testimony was much more sensational then. And I wrote about that in my book that I co-authored with Greg Mitchell, Truth and Consequences. So there's a full coverage of some of that testimony, and the full testimony could also be found at firedoglake.com. But he just was... You know, he's a very smart alecky sort of individual, and sometimes not even giving the prosecutors or David Coombs a straight answer when they're asking questions. And during that time, I do remember Bradley Manning becoming animated. There was something that was said, obviously, that he wanted Coombs to know about, take note of. And beyond that, I can't add much more because it's not clear to me. Nothing publicly has been stated by Bradley Manning about what his view is of Adrian Lamo having been turned in to the federal authorities by him.
Mm-hmm. And so Lamo completed his testimony, was cross-examined, and he's done. Is that right?
The prosecutors don't need him. I think that shows that he's that we focus publicly a lot on the chat logs. It's been a public part of the proceeding, but what this demonstrates to me is there's a lot of evidence that the prosecutors have independently, and I think it's easier for them to not rely on Adrian Lamo, and I think it's actually ultimately good for them. If I'm a prosecutor, I probably wouldn't want Adrian Lamo to be on the stand. That usually is it exposes them and makes them vulnerable. David Coombs has done some of the best work as a defense lawyer when Adrian Lamo has been on the stand.
Mm-hmm. All right. And that was pretty much day two. And then the surprise at the end of day two was that the proceedings were going so quickly that Judge Lind had decided to have hearings on Wednesday and then call a recess for Thursday and Friday. Please explain that.
This baffles me. I have to say that the military, to go more quickly than expected and then not do the work or make the arrangements necessary to get people there by Thursday or Friday so the trial could keep going, I just don't understand. I mean, there's nothing that was in the way of continuing the process, and we know that this is going to be drawn out and go all the way into August. So maybe we're going faster, and that's an indication that will be done by the end of July. But still, as somebody who's cleared his entire summer to be there covering this trial, and then the larger issue, you know, let's not just talk about me. That's pretty vain. But let's talk about Bradley Manning, the fact that he's an individual who has been in prison in pretrial confinement for over 3 years, and he's been waiting for this trial, and then all of a sudden to have it interrupted because of a logistical hiccup, and they're not going to correct it. I don't know. I mean, I think it says something about the military, too. It's kind of surprising that they couldn't just use their power to get those witnesses who are supposed to be testifying there by Thursday or Friday. And so ultimately, it was a positive for me. I was able to cover other significant stories pertaining to national security and civil liberties, but I was ready for this trial, and I think Bradley Manning was ready for this trial to go the entire week.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is curious, and you know, in any other proceeding I've seen, they'll shuffle the deck and say, well, you can call another witness who's nearby. So the idea that they're following the prosecutor's script here and calling a pause in the proceedings so that the next round of witnesses can travel to Fort Meade, it does seem strange, I have to say. Now, I was struck by, first of all, the odd name, but also some of the testimony on day three from Chief Warrant Officer Hondo Hack. Now, I don't want to make any bad jokes here about somebody's ethnic background, but the name Hack is pretty unusual, as is Hondo. And here we are talking about one of the biggest computer hacking jobs of all time, or at least more the most notorious one. And here comes a guy aptly named Hack. Putting aside my fascination with Hack's name, was the interchange between the prosecution and defense as Hack was testifying about whether or not Manning was being accused of, quote, dereliction of duty.
Right, I think I know what you're referring to. And I'll just say that I saw this person, his appearance, he had like a thin-lined mustache that ran into a kind of faint goatee. He kind of looked like maybe someone who would work in a garage, maybe like a greasy sort of person who would work on motorcycles or something.
Mm-hmm.
And just to give you a sense of who this individual was like to me as I watched him give testimony. And he was describing, well, let me back it up. So the prosecutors were trying to set up this sort of, present this testimony that would suggest Bradley Manning had been spending most of his time preparing documents for release to WikiLeaks rather than doing the work that he was supposed to do. Coombs was aware of this. It was very good of him and for to be alert, because as somebody watching the proceedings, I did not pick up on this. But he was ready to ask questions, and when he asked some questions, in fact, the prosecutors raised objection, and the prosecutor admitted that, in fact, they were trying to get some testimony that suggested he was derelict because he had been doing other things rather than his work. What was fascinating to hear from Hack, though, is just it really makes me wonder about our military, because he essentially revealed that, and I don't think this is an isolated instance, that the intelligence section that Bradley Manning was in was a bunch of lower-level juniors who were incapable of collecting intelligence for high-value targets, for going after supposed enemies. And Hondo and this other person, Jurlea, who were superior officers, had to do the work themselves. But it's not really clear that they were any better than the others. It's actually not clear that Bradley Manning was all that bad, because all he did, part of the objection or part of the what the prosecutors were presenting, was that he had gone like 2 years back in the Iraq war logs and provided a military report that showed the name of an individual, and it was someone who could have been targeted as a high value target. And that seemed to be productive, though Hondo didn't seem to think that that had helped much. But overall, I guess the point I would just leave people with is that I got the sense that this section that Bradley Manning was working in was not very good at fighting the war in Iraq, and it made me think that a lot of other sections in the military weren't very good at finding these people. And it just made me think that there's probably a lot of instances over the course of the Iraq war where soldiers were just shooting and killing people who they weren't sure who they were, and they didn't know if they were enemies at all, and they all died, and those were probably war crimes in and of themselves.
Kevin, the last bit of testimony on this third day of the trial that at least piqued my interest was from Captain Casey Fulton, who you referenced earlier. And Fulton was asked if people like Bradley Manning were discouraged from surfing the secret portion of the internet that they had access to, where we park all of these classified documents and other data. And I thought that was very interesting, because you write, Fulton said that there was no prohibition or anything to discourage surfing the SIPR net, the secret network with government information. And so this means that the kind of prospecting that he did of looking around and kind of filtering what he might give to WikiLeaks and what he decided not to give to WikiLeaks, that this was all within the approved realm of his security clearance.
Exactly. If you had no work to do, she said, there wasn't any wrong with you surfing the CIPRNet for professional development. It's actually good for an analyst to know more information than you might think a normal person would know. It makes them better at doing their job. That would just be common sense. The other reality is that Bradley Manning, you know, and what he was doing was supposed to look for enemy threats. The enemy to our military is global. It's everywhere. So it would make sense that you might go to other countries and read about what was happening if there were attacks, read about how the military or even diplomats were responding, and go through this. It's come out also that the U.S. diplomatic cables, particularly the ones in Iraq, though the prosecutors like to claim that Manning had no proper authorization to be reading those, well, he was encouraged to read the Iraqi cables, and he was encouraged to look at this information. And I would think it would have been reasonable to look at other Middle Eastern countries. So it really shows just how they are grasping at and trying to put together charges and allegations against Manning that have no merit whatsoever.
And Kevin, that's the testimony that I have found interest in, that I've gleaned from your coverage. Is there anything I've missed that you think is significant that our listeners should know about from the first 3 days of the Bradley Manning court-martial proceedings?
No, but I said this before in a prior podcast. I'll just make a general point, and I won't go into a lot of detail, and people can follow my coverage and see how I continue to go back to this throughout the trial this summer. But it should, again, be mentioned that none of the information that Manning is alleged to have disclosed, or he has confessed to disclose, that remains classified to our U.S. government. And so we will be hearing a lot of absurd statements from the judge, from prosecutors, throughout the whole entire trial process, and even the military expert who briefs us, who briefs the press. We will be hearing some very absurd statements, and I will continue to have, as everyone else, this information that Manning disclosed available to me. I'll be able to reference it and do my reporting. It will make everything I do much better, but there's going to be discussion about these releases behind closed doors, and you and I are not going to be able to talk about it at all.
Right, yeah. Well, Kevin, I want to thank you for this debriefing on week one of the Bradley Manning court martial, and I appreciate your commitment to be there throughout the summer. I'd like to try to catch up with you once a week as your schedule permits. I want your filing deadlines to be met before we add this to your agenda. But I really think that we need to supply this alternative coverage because the corporate media, as we've discussed, is just going to be zipping in and out of the case. And I am one American who believes that we deserve the full picture, the entire mosaic, and not simply selected sound bites from a very lengthy proceeding. So go ahead.
It would be my pleasure. I mean, I think that the message, just to drive home here, and I've come to this realization over the last few years, is, you know, let's stop harping on the corporate media. I think they're going to realize that they're a tremendous failure, and they could go, they could face their own demise because they have not done what they should be doing as members of the Fourth Estate. Let's help the alternative and independent media that do find this to be important. And so I thank you for spending some time to discuss my coverage.
All right, and I want to once again direct people to firedoglake.com. There's a big banner right at the top that takes you to the page where the latest coverage of the Bradley Manning trial is available from Kevin Gostola. Thanks, Kevin. We'll talk to you again real soon.
All right. Bye, Peter.
And now, San Francisco stand-up comic Will Durst sits down right in front of the microphone to talk to you.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with a few choice words about how strange it is to see France getting their panties all in a wad over gay marriage. Thousands of folks recently took to the streets to express their extreme doubts as to how much freedom should be leaking out of the same-sex side of their famously perforated liberty hose. It's so counterintuitive. We're talking about the French here. The very same people who have an entire category of kissing named after them. A slippery kind of kissing. The best kind. When you call someone a French lover, it doesn't mean they're experts at missionary style, if you catch my drift. You never hear people swear like a sailor, then ask you to pardon my Cantonese. No, it's pardon my French. To honor the nation that prides itself on riding jaded sophistication into new galactic orbits. The French, who witness funerals of heads of state attended by both wives and mistresses, and collectively yawn. That worships fashion like nuns at a Vatican theme park while the kids are slugging down red wine for lunch. An entire nation that eats snails and bark and moss and pretty much anything that grows on the side of trees, and two men kissing as the capital of romance, screaming in the streets? Doesn't make sense. This is like Greece begging to have stricter austerity measures imposed, or the Irish demanding shorter drinking hours, Germany encouraging everyone to lighten up, America requesting international cooperation, Canadians asking to be put in charge of something, anything, the Italians marching in unison. This is France, the country you normally associate with the moral rectitude of a cat in heat on Mexican spring break during the ecstasy harvest. Next, they'll start whining about all the butter and cream in their diet, Might be time to switch to margarine and skim milk. Nespa? For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
And we'll close out today with Graham Nash's song for Bradley Manning. Look it up at YouTube. There's a great video that goes along with this. Let's keep the faith for Bradley Manning.
Almost done.